Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hey, this is Annabelle Bacon, one of the producers here at Death, Sex, and Money. And this week, we're re-airing our most listened to episode of all time. It's called Let's Talk About Porn. We wanted to revisit this episode because we've spent the past few weeks on the show thinking about how we learn about sex. And for many of us, pornography plays a role at some point. And as you'll hear in this episode, our relationships with porn can be so complicated. You sent us stories about how porn helped you get comfortable with your sexuality and also how it's damaged your relationships out in the real world. Okay, here's the show.
Currently, my wife is out of town. We've been married 7 years. For the past 20, I have been addicted to pornography.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
Hey, man, got a big box of porn for you.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
I don't actually have sex other than when I do porn.
And need to talk about more.
I thought all porn stars had fake boobs.
I'm Anna Sale.
Hi. I'd ask that you not use my name or my location. I would like to remain anonymous.
We got this voice memo last spring from a listener I'll call James. He'd stopped looking at porn months earlier, at his wife's urging. Now she was away, and those old cravings were coming back.
It is hard as fucking nails for me to want to not do anything about it. She's going to be gone for another 11 days. I'm afraid that I am not strong enough to make it on my own. I hope I am. We'll find out.
Hearing this message made us wonder how more of you feel about porn. So we asked you, and a lot of you responded.
Porn?
My husband and I both watch porn.
We almost didn't get married because of it.
I was living this double life of being a goody-goody church kid and getting just depraved as hell on my computer every night.
If I'm not having sex, I'm definitely watching all sorts of porn.
It's very hard for me to watch porn and not feel like I'm watching women get raped.
I would watch it, I would masturbate, and then afterwards, I would just feel gross.
Even though it confused the hell out of me, I'm still thankful for it.
I swear, every time that I do look at it, I really believe that it will be my last time, but then sometime within the next week or so, it creeps back in and lures me in.
You told us about when you first learned about porn, what turns you on, how you use porn, and why it's caused real problems for some of you. Something else we learned about porn? It is hard to talk about. We use porn in our most private moments. So when I asked you about it, even my most basic questions could sound really intrusive. Do you watch on your phone, on your laptop?
You know, it's like desktop. I need to be comfortable.
Phone is the easiest.
How do you hold your phone up? while you're watching?
With my left hand.
This is very technical questions.
At their request, we changed all of the names of the listeners in this episode, including this woman, who asked to go by Rose. It wasn't until she was in her 30s that she first came across porn on her smartphone.
So I was looking at Tumblr, and it popped up to my surprise.
And what'd you see?
It was a scene of two people coming into a room, and they had oral sex, and then they had traditional sex.
Did you like watching it?
I did. At first I was, you know, kind of shocked, and I was at my mom's house, so, you know, I had to put it away, and then I went back and looked at it. The first part of it, they were in love, and I was also going through a heartbreak at that time and really craving affection and love and desire, and seeing that acted out, I found it satisfying.
Did you discover things by watching porn about what turned you on?
A little bit. I did get dissatisfied that the camera was always focused on the woman. I was like, I want to see what the guy is doing. How is he reacting to this? But I would notice there was one girl, and she just looked to be enjoying herself so much that I was like, wow, I would like to experience that.
Rose spent a lot of time with porn that weekend, but after that, she says it started to feel boring and scripted. She doesn't watch much anymore. Antonio, on the other hand, is relying on porn more than ever.
The first thought that comes to my head is, thank God for gay porn that I didn't do anything, because that would feel so horrible right now if I had.
Antonio recently moved in with his boyfriend of 2 years. They're monogamous, but that's not always easy for Antonio.
You know, I have these thoughts, and these thoughts will start growing. They'll start getting closer to the surface and bubbling. I think a lot of most of my friends, when we talk about it, I think it's a pretty general term, is that you get thirsty. And everything triggers a thought.
So when you're feeling that way, do you go back to certain scenes or certain videos that you know have turned you on before, or is it always kind of something that's novel and different?
No, there's definitely themes to the types of videos that I watch.
What's your type? How would you describe it?
It's always mostly scenarios where there is a relatively older man, a younger man, doctor patient, teacher student, best friend's dad with best friend's friend. There's definitely some sort of authority thing going on with some sort of like generational gap and, you know, old leading the young.
Before he started dating his current boyfriend, Antonio experimented with trying out some of these fantasies in real life.
It was interesting knowing, if I actually lived this in reality, will I want it a lot in reality?
Mm-hmm.
And will I maybe wean myself off porn and just have this, and then maybe that'll be my thing. I know that I want to be with a man who's older. And I had a couple of real life experiences, and they were great, they were fantastic, but they were still not realistic. There was a disconnect where I liked them, I enjoyed them, I fantasized about them. I don't know if I want to have them in my real life. I want my real life to be what I have now. You know, it's just two guys in their early 30s. And there's no, you know, stereotype or archetype.
Figuring out your relationship to porn when you're in a relationship with another person is something a lot of you have tangled with.
I think I hide my porn watching from him.
Anytime we'd have sex, he'd have to watch porn to get going, which was a real kick in the balls.
You know, it makes me feel inadequate, and it makes me feel like you're looking for something that I can't give you.
In a married relationship with little to no sex at all, I needed some sort of a release.
I would watch with boyfriends or, you know, my husband now.
This was a secret thing that he did, and the only reason I found out is because I caught him one night when he wasn't in bed with me.
She doesn't care too much. Like, she's okay with me watching it. She just doesn't watch any on her own that I know. Maybe she does, but I don't know.
This is Martin. He's open with his wife about how he uses porn, But when he got a letter in the mail that threatened to reveal his habits publicly, he panicked.
I was frightened. Like, very frightened.
Martin had been illegally downloading porn. A company tracked him down with his IP address and demanded $1,000 for every video.
That's actually like a really, really big number. Like in my case, it would have been over $30,000. Then the attorney said, like, why don't you offer them $10,000 and let's make it a deal? And they accepted.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money.
Did you have the $10,000 to pay a lump sum?
I did. I was lucky enough to have it. It's money I have from my emergency fund, and if something goes wrong with me or with my family, then the money isn't there. Like, my wife and I want to have children, and, you know, like, all that money will have been very well employed into, like, medical bills or anything for the kid, and it's not there.
When did you tell your wife that...
Immediately.
Was she angry with you that you were going to lose this amount of money because of illegally downloading porn?
Oddly, no. She actually was very supportive of me, which, I mean, it sounds weird because it's such a stupid way to lose money and it's enraging.
Do you still have the porn that you downloaded before?
Well, they make me pay a lot of money for those movies, so yes, I kept them. I actually have
it's
them.
It's your like, $10,000 collection.
Yeah. I mean, I never watch them because it's painful to think about this, but they are there.
Martin says he still watches other porn. He streams it now, most evenings after work, after he walks the dogs, and before his wife gets home. He says it's relaxing. Coming up, we hear from people for whom porn is the opposite of relaxing, including James, the listener who was trying to resist while his wife was away.
I love her more than I love the porn. And eventually that was one of the largest motivators for me to want to get clean and start talking about this.
When we first aired this episode, we also featured a listener we're calling Lily. She wrote an email to us in 2016 titled, "I don't watch porn, I am porn."
Well, every weekday I get online and I am a cam girl. And so what that means is people can pay me to do certain things that are sexual on camera.
She started right after she graduated college.
I had a part-time job. I wasn't starving or, you know, about to be on the streets. I didn't need the money, but I wanted it.
Lily performed every Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to noon. She told us she made anywhere from $6 to $300 in a shift.
Like, I will flash my boobs for this price or show my butt for this price or... I'm sorry, I'm feeling, like, shy about it.
Back then, Lily told us she wasn't sure how long she'd keep camming, so we wanted to check in with her to see if she's still doing it today.
Yeah, I actually just did yesterday, though it's more sporadic than it used to be.
Lily works full-time in education now, but she says she still gets on camera once or twice a week.
It can be really fun, and I make some money doing it, and that's good enough, I guess.
We also wanted to know what camming had taught her about sex that she hadn't learned growing up.
I was pretty sheltered growing up, and so once I got to college and I was on my own, it was like I couldn't stand up for myself, and that's something that's changed so much. I definitely say no to people all the time when I'm camming because you just have to. There's no other way to do it. You have to have a thick skin and you have to be sure of yourself and know how to deal with people in a polite way, but also just be really firm.
All month long, we've been talking about what you learned and didn't learn about sex in our series, Our Sex Miseducations. If you want to hear all the episodes in this series, visit deathsexmoney.org/sexed. On the next episode, Anna talks with poet Nikki Giovanni live on stage about her 50-year career, which started at the height of the Black Arts Movement in the 1960s.
I'm not going to get killed for writing bad poetry, but there are people who have gotten killed for trying to tell the truth. And so I just think that all I wanted to do was my share. And I had a story to tell, and I thought that I should tell it.
Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this for me is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. One of the things we heard from a lot of you about porn is how it's shown you what you like and what you don't like.
I am an avid porn watcher, and I have been for many, many years.
I've been able to explore my sexuality with it and kind of hone in on what it is that I like and what it is that turns me on.
I've definitely noticed that my taste has gotten more extreme over the years.
She has sometimes the role of the kind of assertive, dominant person, and sometimes I do.
One of the things I do really enjoy are lesbian porn videos, which is funny because I'm straight identifying.
I think we have a very fulfilling experience because of our knowing what we want and asking for what we want.
I've never really watched it with a lover, but something I would be open to, but it's very, very personal to me.
A listener named Michael has been watching porn and collecting it since he was a teenager. He sees it as the ultimate form of self-care.
You know, there are days where just everything goes wrong, and it's just like, you know what? I'm going to give myself this, and it's going to feel good, and I'm going, you know, to use this beautiful material to love myself for 20 minutes.
Michael's married now, and he watches porn a few times a week. He keeps his collection on a special hard drive that he hasn't shown anyone.
My porn is really, really boring. It, you know, it's like these videos of domestic couples making breakfast together and then having sex, you know, and it's beautifully lit and shot. And so, you know, it made me realize, okay, like this more sadomasochistic stuff is not for me.
You were drawn to like domestic scenes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Isn't that funny? And also, it was an affirmation, I think, of who I was as a person. I had a lot of questions about, or I didn't have questions. Let me rephrase that. I didn't have questions about who I was sexually as a teenager. And, you know, I've always been attracted to girls. But when people meet me, their first assumption is that I'm gay because I have this feminine, these feminine gestures about me, the way I carry myself. And so I think watching porn completely in private and investigating in what aroused me, like, gave me a very safe space to figure out and affirm, yep, this is what I like.
Hmm. Was that comforting?
Yes. Absolutely.
Have you ever felt like you're using porn too much and you need to let go of it?
Yeah, I do. There have been times, you know, well, when you're a teenager, it's like all night. But, you know, like in my like mid-20s or so, it would just be, okay, I've done this for 3 hours. That's probably too much. Mm-hmm. But then like deleting the collection is like a gut reaction. It's like a knee-jerk reaction to go extreme in the other way. And
would you delete it?
Yeah. But then, of course, I always have a backup.
You always
have
a backup. And you know you have a backup.
Always have a backup, Anna.
So you would delete it because you felt ashamed?
Yes. And then I would say, wait a minute. Where is that shame coming from? Why do I feel shame about this when it feels so good? And I think, all right, you know, what would happen if I died and, you know, my wife's, you know, like rooting through, and my family's rooting through my belongings, and they find my hard drive filled with porn. What are they going to think? Oh my God, you know, my son, how could he look at all this porn? It's just like, why is it not accepted to be attracted to beautiful images? I don't have shame in it. Like, I'm happy to admit it.
But you think about what will happen if you die suddenly and what people will find.
Yeah, if they, you know, they're going to find this collection of high art erotica that I tend like a rose garden. It's highly curated.
For Michael, porn is precious, something worth protecting. But for some of you, porn feels like a major threat. It's taken you to dark corners of the internet and of yourself, like for Daniel.
When it got really bad, it would be like several times a day. And I was looking at it like outside of the house, like on my cell phone at work and like in the bathroom and stuff.
Like you would take your phone into the bathroom at work and watch a video?
Mm-hmm.
That was about 3 years ago. It was not a good time in Daniel's life. He was drinking too much. He gained a lot of weight. His relationship with his longtime girlfriend was fraying.
And, you know, it just kind of all culminated into this, like, giant ball of shit and where I just started to feel really disconnected and ended up, like, in the hospital, like in the psychiatric ward.
Daniel has OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. One of his symptoms is intrusive, recurring sexual thoughts.
My OCD kind of all started with these sexual thoughts about children. And I've never hurt a child, never been inappropriate in any way. It's just those thoughts have popped into my head when, you know, I'm having sex. And that's another thing that I've had to talk myself down from.
That must be terrifying.
It sucks, you know, and it was really terrifying for a long time.
Daniel says he's never looked at child pornography. Just having those thoughts about children was deeply upsetting. He says he was using other porn to escape those thoughts. Daniel's getting therapy regularly now. He's on medication, too, and he's completely eliminated porn from his life. But he says it's hard to stay away from it.
So I still think about it on a daily basis, and I would definitely say it's like a kind of like a craving.
Do you think it's because of your particular mental health makeup that porn is difficult for you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why. You know, it wasn't something else. I just feel like that was probably, honestly, the best sort of vice that was suited for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was it a problem in your relationship?
It wasn't one we talked about, but, I mean, it was definitely a problem. You know, she would say that when we had sex, sometimes it felt like I was looking, like, at her, not like she was an object, just, like, taking in her body and not, like, taking in her. And I can kind of, I mean, I know what she's talking about. It was, like, kind of a disconnect.
Hmm. Is it possible to have sex that doesn't feel hard now with your girlfriend?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, like, is there ever a time when we have sex where I don't have to talk to my brain? Like, use my conscious part to talk to my sort of unconscious part? No, you know, but it doesn't mean it's not good.
So, like, what's a sentence that you have to tell yourself?
I'd be like, that's not real. That doesn't mean anything. It's, you're like, that's not really what you want. Like, think about what you really want.
Has it gotten simpler since you've eliminated porn from your life?
Yeah.
In what way? What's changed?
I don't go down that rabbit hole. I know it's like an addiction. I want to pull myself, but I know I can't look at it. Like, if I go on the internet, I'll start typing into a browser, and I will want to type in, like, the address to a porn site. I can feel it, and I'll just breathe. And I know how terrible it would feel if I went to one, how bad I would feel even just going and looking at it. Even if I opened it and closed it, I would feel so bad. It's hard because it gives me a really intense feeling, a really intense sort of pleasurable feeling, but it's also usually followed by a lot of shame, too.
Daniel describes a rush, followed by regret, then the urge to do it all again, like an addict. But the idea of porn as something you can be addicted to is a controversial one. The American Psychiatric Association has not classified porn addiction as a mental disorder. And this month, the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists spoke out against the idea of porn addiction, saying scientific evidence is lacking and the term can unduly pathologize sexual problems. but understanding porn as an addiction has been useful for James, the listener who was waiting for his wife to get home from her work trip.
I'm afraid that I am not strong enough to make it on my own.
Were you strong enough to make it on your own?
I did. I was in a place where that feeling of being overwhelmed by loneliness was a really bad trigger for me, but I kind of pulled myself out of my own head.
When was the last time you consumed porn?
Somewhere in the range of about a month ago. I relapsed. At the time I relapsed, I was about 380 days clean. And I was very upset with myself that I allowed myself to cross that line.
Porn has been an issue in James's marriage for years. He and his wife were both virgins when they got married. And his wife told him his porn habit made her feel inexperienced and inadequate.
Finally, my wife looked at me one day in the car. We just had a big fight. I told her, again, that I'd looked at pornography. And she said to me, "I'm done." She says, "I have nothing left. You're either going to find a way to walk free of this, or I'm walking away."
So it was an ultimatum.
Yeah, it was a very clear ultimatum for me.
What do you do to try to control the enticement to just go to a porn website?
Well, I'm very open about talking with my wife. I actually have software that monitors my web usage and submits a weekly report to her and to other individuals.
Wait, to your wife?
To my wife, yeah. That's my choice. So she receives a weekly report of, you know, websites I visited. If she sees a trend, you know, she'll approach me about it. In the past year, you know, it's been like less than three times that I've had issues with porn. It's like my wife has turned to me and said, you know, and she voluntarily just came out with, you know, "I feel like this is the best year of our marriage that we've ever had. And we've been married, you know, for a while." I mean, you know, in full disclosure, I've had some of the best sex in my life in the past year.
No matter what, whether you use porn or you don't, talking about it makes you get really honest about what you wonder about and what feels like a step too far. Sharing your browser history can be more exposing than sharing your sexual history.
Actually, I wouldn't mind it if somebody I was dating found out what I was looking at. I'd be like, go for it. In fact, I'd share it with them. I'd hope I'd share it with them.
Jennifer says when she's dating, it's helpful to bring porn up because it quickly reveals someone's personality and values around sex.
I'm like, when do you watch porn? What kind of porn do you watch? And I feel like it makes guys so uncomfortable. And it's not that I'm trying to push their buttons, but in a way, I want them to be comfortable with talking to me about it because I think it's important to just get it out of the way. And you can have kind of a better sex life. I mean, not kind of a better sex life. You can have a better sex life when all the cards are out on the table and people are willing to discuss.
What did you learn from porn about what you like?
I can get really psychological about it. I think a lot of people, you know, my tastes have definitely changed. And then I'm like, what does this mean about me? Trauma in my childhood, you know, just psychoanalyzing yourself. But I think it's easy to just, you know, kind of explore, especially on Tumblr, and be like, oh, I could get down with this today, but maybe not tomorrow. And see something that might be a little too extreme and be backpedal. Like, I'm not going to go down that road.
You mean it's sort of like there's the one part of you that's exploring, like, maybe this is going to turn me on. And then there's the other intellectual part of you that's like, is this healthy for me to be indulging?
Is that what totally. You mean? And then when you're, and then when you orgasm, you're like, who cares? It's over.
Thank you to so many of you for sharing your stories about porn. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. I'm based at the Center for Investigative Reporting in Emeryville, California. The team includes Katie Bishop, Chester Jesus Soria, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. Our interns are Allie Lesperance and Rich Rinalik. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. Thanks to Hannes Brown for additional original music and scoring in this episode. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale. The show is at Death Sex Money. And please go to deathsexmoney.org/donate to support the show. Most of the stories we got from you were about internet porn, but some of you took us back to simpler times when you'd wander into the adult section at the video store and admire some of the great titles of yesteryear.
You know, like Shaving Ryan's Privates was one of my favorites. Mr. Holland's Orifice.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.